This morning we are looking at the second last passage that we're going to look at in the book of Hebrews, and then we're going to start into something new. This morning, Hebrews 13, verses 1 to 3. I know you hear me say this an awful lot, but this is a really, really important passage in Hebrews. not that the other ones weren't. They just keep getting better in these last three chapters. And so Hebrews chapter 3, verses 1 to 3. I'm reading from the NIV, which is a little different than the Bible you have in front of you in the pew, but you can follow along there as well and keep that open or on your device, whatever you have this morning. This is Hebrews chapter 3, verses 1 to 3. Keep on loving one another as brothers and sisters. Do not forget to show hospitality to strangers, for by so doing, some people have shown hospitality to angels without knowing it. Continue to remember those in prison as if you were together with them in prison, and those who are mistreated as if you yourselves were suffering. I want to read a story this morning, and it's a bit of a longer story, but I'm going to read it anyways because it sets up well what I want to talk about this morning right out of this passage. So this is a story by a lady named Lori Freeland who wrote this story for crosswalk.com, which is a website that does like social stuff and Christianity and devotionals and those kinds of things, and she wrote it for that. Although it might seem like the subject matter of this story is divorce, that is not the case. So I encourage you to listen to the end. You can feel the pain in her voice as she shares this story. When I was 19, my dad decided to call quits on his 25-year marriage, even though he told my sister and me he was divorcing our mom and not us. That's not exactly the way our lives played out. The day that he left, he packed his stuff, drove out of state, and settled with the woman who'd asked him to leave. Widowed and with two small boys, she convinced him to marry her and adopted her kids and raised them as his own. Over that year, his infrequent trips to see my sister and I dwindled down to zero. I loved my dad, and up until he left, we'd been close. Determined to keep some kind of relationship, I'd asked if I could come visit him and his new wife, and there was a lot of hesitation on his end. Despite our back and forth on weekends that didn't work with his schedule, I pressed him to settle on a day and drove the 3 hours to his new house. When I got there, he was waiting for me alone. After a few awkward false starts, we shared a meal and got more comfortable until new wife came home. Not only did she barely spare me a glance, she changed out of her work clothes and left for the evening. While she was gone, her kids and I watched movies while my dad worked in his home office. The boys were sweet, new wife, not so much. Later that night, new wife finally returned and zipped past me again. And after she tucked her boys in, she stood at the top of the stairs and she yelled to my dad to come up to bed. Good night. My dad got up from his recliner and headed towards the stairs. A little panic set in. I looked at my suitcase still sitting where I dropped it in the entranceway right next to my shoes. And oh, he turned from the top of the stairway. You're sleeping in one of the boys' rooms. And he pointed behind him to a closed door. Then he went to bed. I picked up my bag, went to the room where he had pointed. The bed had been slept in. The top and bottom sheets left rumpled and far from clean. There was no pillow, no blanket, and no welcome. My chest caved, and I fell to the floor next to that unmade bed, and I cried. After sleeping in my clothes, using my jacket for a pillow, I got up the next morning and drove home. What I didn't realize was that earlier that year, new wife had given him an ultimatum, his old family or the new one, and it was fairly obvious what he had chosen. That awful, awkward night I spent in my dad's house stayed with me. So did the chest-crushing realization that I was unwanted and unwelcome. Now I have a house of my own, with a guest room, and to make sure the bed is always made, the sheets are always clean, and there are enough pillows for five. I've painted the walls a warm burgundy and placed a lamp and photographs on the nightstand. My hope is that everything about that room shouts, "You're wanted. You're welcome. Come back anytime." I never want to make anyone feel the way I did that night that I visited new wife and my dad. Jesus said, "Anyone who welcomes you welcomes me. And anyone who welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me." What we have in our passage for today is the beginning of what are considered the final exhortations. By the way, this is me talking now, not the lady telling the story. What we have in this passage are these final exhortations that the writer of Hebrews wants us to understand and hear before he or she finishes their letter. And these first three verses are as critically important for us now in this day and age, I would argue, as they were then. The writer has been setting the stage for this. The supremacy of Christ, we've heard this numerous times, this better way, this better day, not a new religious system built on the old one that they had inherited, but a complete replacement of that system, an overlaying, if you will, creating the capacity to do what one could not do before. Now it has practical implications, though. Things they must do, things they must not lose sight of. And so begins this section of exhortations in chapter 13. Commands, or the things that they are called to. Clear lines of obedience to follow because of all of this that he's set up. And in these verses, these first three verses, we begin to see a pattern that is to be repeated or replicated. And what I see here is this, quite simply put, love and care for one another and love and care for others. And in so doing, you show your love for me. It's it in a nutshell, really. It's not that complicated. So first, what we see here in this very first verse is brotherly love. And you've heard this word before in the original language. Philadelphia. They won the Super Bowl 2 years ago. That's the city of what? Brotherly love. And that's what this word means here. And it doesn't mean some kind of general caring for society or philanthropy. It means it's a peculiar love that Christians are to have for one another, for their brothers and sisters. Brotherly love. Or the home of Rocky Balboa. I don't know either way. And the second one that we have here is a word you probably haven't heard. You've heard the English word lots. And I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, but it's philoxenia. Or philoxenia, which means love or affection of for strangers, which is our word for hospitality, the love of strangers. Now, you may not realize this, but this is highly reflective of their Near Eastern, their Middle Eastern context, and the cultural expectations and the extension of hospitality is not just something you do because you're a good person. No, it's a way of life. I came across an article by two American ladies who are of Middle Eastern descent who went on a trip through the Middle East, and they wrote about their travels, particularly hospitality. And this is what they said. There is not one variety of olives on the table, but three. And hummus, an eggplant, pita, pickles, cheese. There are main courses, two of them, in case one might not like the first one. And fresh cucumbers and tomatoes and okra and onions and eggs. Everywhere in the Middle East, the traveler is overwhelmed by hospitality. The virtue seems to be an inescapable product of the landscape. Even as even as we travel in our air-conditioned car with all the water that we need sitting right beside us, we are stunned by the heat, the distances between towns whose names reveal their most salient or significant feature. Beersheba, Sheba's Well, En Gedi, it's a spring. To refuse a man refreshment in such a place is to let him die. It's their nomadic way of life. No wonder then the landscape that gave birth to the three great monotheistic religions, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, one God religions, no wonder that the landscape that gave birth to these three produce in those who follow those ways, those adherents to those religions, place so great an emphasis on hospitality. In the Quran, as well as in the Hebrew and Christian Bibles, the mistreatment of strangers is a sure way to incur divine wrath. All three of those religions, it's true. These three verses don't stand alone. They stand within the greater context of the whole of the gospel story and under sort of the broader arc of the story of God's dealing with humanity, if you will. From start to finish, the gospel story is one of God welcoming us in and loving us. Failed love on our part, perfect love on his part. Poor hospitality on our part, wonderful, inviting hospitality on his. He came in need, a pregnant teenager in need of a room for the night. No room. Hospitality fail. John's gospel said he came unto his own and his own received him not. Hashtag hospitality fail. Again. Paul says in Ephesians and Colossians that we were too once far away, alienated. He uses the word stranger. And he welcomed us in. That's hospitality language. In John 13, Jesus washes his disciples' feet. That's a hospitality action. You see that in the Old Testament in a couple of different places, but Genesis 18 and chapter 19 as well. You see Abraham. You remember that story? God's meeting with him under the tree, and then he sees three strangers, and he goes out to meet them, and he brings them in and washes their feet. Lot talks about the same thing, just one chapter over, two visitors, and come so we can wash your feet. Hospitality language. Then, of course, there's the Lord's Supper, which is a beautiful, hospitable invitation to come and dine. Jesus, in this case, is the host and also the provider of the sustenance for our journey, if you will. Hospitality, come and dine. And many scholars see in the language here, in the language of what we talked about or we even sang about earlier, when Jesus returns, the language of Christ's return, hospitality language. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, we hear this verse that says, we will meet him in the air. That's the Near Eastern practice. Some see this as that Near Eastern practice of going out. You look and you see your guests coming from afar, your visitors, and so you go and meet them. Bring them back to your home, like Abraham did. The whole of the Christian narrative, if I can use that language, is bookended conceptually and actually by and in the practice of hospitality. Can't be overstated, can't be escaped, can't be overlooked. It's here and it's what we're called to. So what I use this language, I hope this translates, but it's this idea of a reciprocal responsibility. Let me explain it like this. Because we love because he loved us first. That's reciprocal responsibility. We forgive because he forgave us first. And in this instance, we show his welcoming love and mercy and compassion by likewise being a people of practical hospitality, real hospitality. It's particularly interesting at the end of this passage how the writer uses and mentions this idea of those in prison and in kind of in the mistreated. It's sort of a put yourself in their shoes kind of ways. Think of them like you were there. And it's interesting language because I think maybe what's going on here is he's drawing on the lesson that Jesus teaches in the Gospels about the way we treat others in need is a reflection of how we treat him. Noah read for us from Matthew chapter 25, the parable of the sheep and the goats. Jesus separated the herd, the sheep to the right and the goats to the left. Those in the right are granted their inheritance, and it's tied together because of their the fact of their participation in hospitable acts to the least of these. And then Jesus equates himself as one of the least of these. However, the goats, those on the left, not so fortunate, are they? They are cast out for their failure, essentially, to do the same. There's an interesting side note here about the religion Islam. The hospitality relationship in Islam is a triangular one, including host and stranger and God. Sustenance is a right rather than a gift, and the duty to supply it is a duty to God, not the stranger. So there you have it. As the writer begins to wrap up and say goodbye, as it were, a few more really important things here. And are at the heart of all that it is at the heart of it all. That Jesus' heart, a welcoming heart, an open heart, a hospitable heart, a love of strangers' heart. Because that's what that word means, remember? I want to say something, some of you may at first might think that it's just like a radical overstatement. Just to make a point. And I don't actually think it's true. I believe that if we don't do, if we don't be those kind of people, that kind of people, hospitable with Jesus' hearts, the church as we know it, and I don't mean Union Church, I mean church, big C. I believe it will fail. Just fail at its mission, period. I think it's probably too late for many and is nearing that point for a lot of other churches because they've become clubs for the included, not open and welcome for those who've been excluded. I believe this is really that important. The reality of our hospitality or lack of it in any real kind of way to the outside world makes us highly ineffectual, I think, often. And it's a critical aspect for Christian living. We may not be too bad at it in our own circles, actually, hanging out with those we like to hang out with, those we know, those that are like us, those we've become comfortable with, if you will. However, and this first verse here that is in this passage, love one another, okay, good with that. What does Jesus say? If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than others? Do not even pagans do that? One writer has said this, the real practice of hospitality makes people feel they belong. Think of this statement I'm reading now in contrast with that story I read at the beginning. The real practice of hospitality makes people feel they belong. It makes people feel special, important, warmly welcomed into your life, not just your home. It's receiving strangers like they are family and communicating through your words and actions that they are well worth your time and effort. There's an interesting thing that's happened in parts of the world over the last several years or longer with the rapid movement of people into particularly places like Europe because of the horrible conditions in like North Africa and parts of the Middle East. There have been some amazing stories of what has happened in some of these churches. A lot of these churches have seen radical growth. Of people have had the opportunity to be able to be the real Jesus. And Jesus is doing his thing also where he's coming to these people in dreams and visions. And they're finding him. There's been rapid expansion in some churches with Muslims turning to Christ, former enemies welcomed in, needs being met in Jesus' name, real Jesus love being poured out. We know some people who are serving in the heart of this area in some of these places, and they tell stories like this. That's why this stuff matters, because lives are at stake. It just can't be overstated. Listen again. Here's an explanation of the importance of hospitality. The sharing of food together was a token of friendship, a form of a covenant commitment. One of the most despicable acts in the ancient world was to eat with someone and then betray them. Think Judas. This entire code of hospitality in the Middle East was so strong that it evoked a warning. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers. For some have had this experience, like our passage says, and have unknowingly entertained angels. I think that's a direct reference to Abraham. It is also this dimension of mutual commitment in the sharing of food that provides the Eucharist, the Lord's Supper, communion table, with one of its most dynamic and incredible meanings. I believe that in these days of rapid and unprecedented movement of peoples, of course we do see this here too in this part of the world, don't we? Disconnected neighbors, social isolation, the individual pursuit of privacy. At all cost, it's my life, leave me alone. This is a sidebar, it's not in the notes. I can't speak for the States, but in Canada we have entire communities and subdivisions of homes that are designed around get off the street and into your house as quickly as you can. Garages in the front, you drive up, you press the button, you go into your house, you walk into your house, you close the door, you don't have to leave till work the next day. It used to be front porches. It used to be community squares. There's an organization in Vancouver, Canada that did research over the last 10 years, and they asked the question, what is the most significant issue facing people in urban centers today? You might think it's like poverty or something like that, but it's social isolation. Social isolation. Hospitality runs absolutely counter to that idea. Being hospitable people runs absolutely counter and directly towards what is needed in our society. You could go as far to say that hospitality is the new, or always perhaps, divine currency of kingdom economics. It is the gold bullion, if you want to keep using language like that, of a failed monetary system. It is the funding that comes in at the last minute to restore consumer confidence in a recession. That's hospitality. Simply put, the kingdom of God and its expansion on earth in the day and age we live in is ripe for a harvest of souls, and the reaping will be done as real servant hospitality takes hold in the hearts, minds, and lives of Christ followers all over the world. People on mission for Jesus. Folks, this is why small group ministry is so important, being a part of a community like that. This is why joining us on the patio after service is so important. You thought that was just for snacks. And when you are out there, it's important if you see someone you do not know or barely know, that you make it your job, not just my job, but your job to know them better, particularly if they're from somewhere that you don't know much about, or you don't know people that come from that part of the world or whatever. It's critical. I want to call us to go from here today with a new vision for the power of loving Jesus, with a loving Jesus-like hospitality. That's hospitality that has the Jesus model and ethic right at its core, being like Jesus. And I want to ask a couple of questions this morning that just kind of flow logically from this passage. couple simple questions. Do you and I love one another? That's the first command in the first verse. Because it has to start there. It has to start there with radical hospitality first to one another. Learning how to love one another well in the context of what he's talking about here. Do you and I love one another? Keep on loving one another with Philadelphia love, brotherly love. And then secondly, does that love flow out from there in real and actual hospitality to outsiders, to the love of strangers? Folks, love that flows out will never go out. Love that flows out. Love was meant to be given away. And the opposite of this is likely entirely true as well. Fail to love and all is lost. You become isolated, depressed, angry, critical, bitter. Pick whatever word you want to use there. You won't like people anymore at all. So I want to leave us with those two questions. Do we love one another? And are we willing to love out as we're called to, hospitably? Here's a quote to end with. And I'm going to close in prayer. Don't ever underestimate the power of your living room. It's a metaphor here, the living room, the place where you welcome people. Don't ever underestimate the power of your living room as a launching pad for new life and hope and ministry and mission. Let's pray together.